This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors tackle today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is December 5th, 2024. When you do what I do for a living, namely, communicate about all things investing, you meet a lot of people who do the same thing. It's a pretty small world. Anyway, as you get to talking to these people, usually you get around to talking about areas of specialization, comfort, confidence, and most people that you meet, like probably 8 or 9 out of 10, well, they'll say they just love writing about equities. Maybe sustainable investing gets thrown in there too. But it's only that 10th person who answers fixed income. Fixed income can be a complex, hard to explain beast of an asset class. However, it is also an essential one, and you will not go wrong getting a better grasp of it. So today, we're going to talk to three fixed income experts from MSCI about what fixed income markets are telling us as the year ends, and what investors may want to look out for in 2025. Let's get right to it with our first guest.
My name is Afnan Masturi, and I'm taking care of fixed income investing at MSCI. We had a very interesting year in 2024. We have experienced literally all of the different cycles of the market in almost 1 year and 11 months. Markets started the year looking ahead for normalization of the monetary policy on the back of a gradual decline in inflation and the steady growth that we experienced in the second half of the last year. If anything, the first thing that market faced coming into 2024, the first quarter, was resurging the inflation and some of the changes in the underlying drivers of the inflation. So there was a lot of debate if this is the beginning of the path of normalization of monetary policy and the raise of inflation was a false alarm, or this is basically an inflation which was cooking underlying, and the level of inflation that we saw coming off was just a temporary setback in inflation trajectory. Second quarter, we saw that the first group actually proved to be right. The delayed factors contributing to inflation started to gradually soften, and the market started the second half of the year with a view that potentially the monetary policy is on the path of easing. What we faced in the third quarter, softening of the market, was on the back of the view that, oh, maybe the interest rate and the level of the monetary policy for so long was constraining, such that now the growth is at risk. So we saw some sell-off in market during the summer season. Low liquidity contributed to exaggerate and exacerbate the circumstances, but it was an environment that there was a concern that there was a growth concern that was driving the sentiment. As the growth number, the print came and kind of like calmed the market, we headed into an election. The result of election is now clear, and some of the policies are now, that uncertainty is behind us. Some of the policies are better discussed now, at least in public domain. And we are heading into next year with the view that the fundamental drivers of the growth are still quite strong. The year ended basically with a growth between 2.6, or the expectations are consensus between 2.6 to 2.8. which is above the trend growth, quite a strong compared to consensus at the beginning of the year. So the drivers of the growth going into next year is strong, and we expect the continued growth in the macro background. But there are obviously factors that they can introduce tail risks to these views.
Can you be more specific about the factors that drove markets?
Let's not forget that more than half of the population of the world entered the year expecting to participate in form of the election one way or other in some form of election. We saw some significant kind of movement in France, even though the impact on the asset valuation was quite minimal. We saw election in India. So the world entered 2024 with testing the democracies and the power and the impact on economic policies. So far, outside of the U.S. election, most of this this election did have a minor effect on asset valuation and market. Most of them, although showing some changes in the trend of the policies and introducing some policy uncertainties at the policy level, they were less impactful at the global level than the U.S. Election. And U.S. election specifically, and the policies that they take towards their trading partners, would be impactful not just for U.S. and U.S. asset, but also globally. It's undeniable that it would define the direction of the dollar, and the U.S. policy, both fiscal policy and monetary policy, has impact on both corporate planning and also consumer sentiment across the globe.
Of course, the fixed income market is not a monolith. And today, we're going to look at it both generally as well as through the lens of two subsegments. We'll get to one of those, sustainable bonds, a bit later in the program. For now, let's switch over to our second guest.
My name is Yihai Yu. I'm in charge of MSCI Securitized Product Mortgage Research and Models,
who will talk us through the year from the perspective of what's known as securitized products. One of the most well-known of these securities are something called mortgage-backed securities, or MBS, which Yihai explained this way.
I think most of people have some experience to buy a house. Usually people buy a house with mortgages. And when you get the mortgage, usually you get the mortgage through some sort of local either bank or credit union. And those entities usually don't have a lot of capital, or they prefer to hold a security instead of loans, which will expose them to some sort of a local housing market risk instead of a diverse U.S. market as a whole. So one solution, starting from, you know, SNL crisis about 40 years ago, that, you know, a certain investment bank start to pull those loans together in a securitized form and issue them in the form of pools. And then those pools, those securities are backed by mortgages, therefore mortgage-backed securities, more diverse. In terms of housing risk, it can be kind of relatively operational, easier for the government agencies to guarantee the payments. Right now, the securitized products is about $15 trillion market size versus the overall fixed income U.S. is about 55. The securitized products in general have performed well in 2024. Spreads have all tightened across the board. AAA CMBS tightened about 40 bips, AAA card and ABS tightened about 25 bips, CRT B tranche tightened 170 bips. In general, the remarkably resilient economic conditions have mitigated both corporate and consumer credit concerns, especially corporate. Relatively speaking, mortgages have lagged behind other spread products right now. The agency MBS spread is sitting at the lower end of the 25 bips range through 2024, which still outperform the treasuries. This can be mostly attributed to the elevated rates volatilities, which has sparked a strong refinance response, although just for 1 month this October, but still enough to remind investors the negative convexity risk for MBS. The risk themes for 2025 will be apparently Fed rates setting path and how they will balance the maximum employment and the stable prices their due mandates. Of course, the realized inflation, especially under the pressure of tariffs and trade tensions, housing price, which is expected to moderate to the level in line with the historical average.
Yes, housing prices. Please, do go on.
Housing price appreciation is expected to be about 3% for the full year of 2024, right? Which is pretty much in line with the long-term historical average. At the same time, the inflation, or as we, you know, some people call it disinflation, inflation is the rate of inflation is kind of coming down at the 2.1, 2.3 level, is kind of in line with the historical average as well. What the Fed, you know, expects the historical average should be. The risk of house price correction is always there, right? As we, you know, observed a transient negative HPA in the beginning of the rates tightening cycle in, you know, this cycle in 2022. But the fundamentals to support the housing price is still very strong, with limited, you know, housing supply, significant home equity over the past several years, as well as the wealth effect from the stock market and a strong economy in general. HPA for 2025 is more likely stay near the trend of 2024, neither abnormally strong as in COVID period of time or disastrously weak as post the 2008 crisis.
Interest rates and inflation. If you know anything about the factors affecting fixed income, it's interest rates and inflation. But there is one factor that has the potential to impact inflation rates that you might not have seen coming. And that's a little thing we've talked about on this program quite a bit, called the energy transition. Or as Afsana explains,
there is a significant investment required for different economies, depend on their level of dependency on energy, to transition their sources of energy from high emitting sources of energy to more environmental friendly sources of energy. So that's a fact, an undeniable observation in the market. I believe it's kind of consensus, even though the exact number might not be agreed upon. And that's something goes beyond the political system and the policies of one government versus other and versus one regime versus the other. That's if we assume that investment is going to materialize, the source of, and especially if that's coming from the public sector, that's natural to assume that this is going to introduce a large investment demand. And if that's coming from the public sector, that can have consequences for level of inflation and growth, positive impact on growth and potentially push inflation higher in medium term and long term. However, there is also a space for having this constructive debate that does this investment need to be fully provided by public sector? What percentage of that can be the investment or participation of the private sector, and how the private sector participation can diversify the effect of this investment on both inflation and growth? If this has to come fully from the public pocket, it's more likely that this investment to have an inflationary effect, as opposed to when this is coming gradually and through reinvestment, through investment on the public sector, where that's the saving of the private sector that is going into the long-term investment for transition to low-carbon economy.
That brings us to the role and the growth of sustainable bonds, which I mentioned earlier. It also brings us to our third guest today.
Yakub Malik, I work in MSCI's Sustainability and Climate Research team, focusing specifically on fixed income topics. The sustainable bond market, which includes green bonds, social bonds, sustainability bonds, and sustainability-linked bonds, usually this is how it's defined, has indeed experienced tremendous growth in recent years. So if we look at some of the numbers in terms of the outstanding amount, only since 2020, it has quadrupled in size from around $1 trillion US dollars to around $4 trillion US dollars at the end of the first half of this year. So really, in very short period of time, very significant growth. Some of the main factors that we see that are driving this growth, I would say, first of all, it is definitely an increased participation from the corporate sector. This is evidenced by the issuance numbers, and we see now that most of the issuance is being done by private companies or the corporate sectors, and not the government-related entities, as it maybe was the case a couple of years ago. The second and related reason for the growth is definitely that we do see investor demand. Obviously, someone needs to be buying these bonds. And then again, we can measure or evidence with numbers such as the funds tracking green bond indexes and similar metrics, which we do still see increasing year over year. Maybe another and final reason that I would mention here, but very significant one, is the regulatory support and incentives too that we see coming from the governments. So these are the different taxonomies that we see being developed. So there is also increased maybe harmonization among countries and markets in these different taxonomies and regulations. And also some of the markets really provide outright financial incentives to be involved in sustainable finance. And I would say that all of these reasons that I mentioned is to a large extent all supported or related to the global initiatives that we see there. So these are the different, you know, climate agreements that that we reach, such as the Paris Agreement, Glasgow, and so on, that are often discussed and agreed at the UN convened climate conferences.
And here we are back around to what Afsane was talking about in terms of financing the carbon transition, a big topic at those UN climate conferences. So where are sustainable bond investors putting their money? What exactly are they financing?
We do produce this report semi-annually where we look at labeled bonds, called Labeled Bonds, a market overview. And there we try to dissect the trends that we see in this space, this say, sustainable debt or sustainable bond space, by using different metrics that we have here at MSCI. We can look at what kind of sectors are issuing what kind of projects they are financing, how does that maybe relate to some of the climate or the ESG ratings, perhaps, data that we have on the issuers, and whether we can draw any conclusions from these. First of all, it would be that increased the issuance from the corporate sector. I would say that is very important because, corporate issuers, maybe unlike, say, development banks, they generally don't have a positive impact mandate, right? So they must see a commercial sense in doing so, in issuing these bonds and engaging in these transactions. So, of course, these reasons can vary why that is in different sectors, markets, and even among individual corporations. But I would say there are some fundamental maybe reasons why they do want to invest in these projects and finance them. So maybe in some cases it can be because of the regulatory push, you know, let's say to be aligned with the countries or different territories, national determined contributions, or their climate and sustainability goals. They can also be driven by energy transition and, you know, the attempt to benefit from this by maybe lesser reliance on fossil fuels. And of course, to finance different green business ventures that on their own can be profitable. Also, another reason why corporations might choose to issue these bonds is that they see benefits in financing them or trying to take benefit from the market conditions. So, for example, if they see that they can get a more favorable terms on a green bond compared to a conventional bond, the phenomenon known as the greenium, perhaps that would also incentivize them to engage in these transactions. Another major trend that we see in the market is that green bonds clearly dominate, and they account for almost 60% of all labeled or sustainable bonds outstanding. Now, looking more closely into what these green bonds are financing, for those maybe not familiar with green bonds, these bonds are use of proceeds bonds. So the proceeds or funds raised through these instruments must finance specific eligible green projects. So looking at these projects, we see that there is a clear focus on energy transition. So most of these bonds finance projects related to alternative energy sources, energy efficiency projects, and similarly. So that also signifies the focus on transition in this market compared to maybe some other themes, let's say, such as pollution and so on. We also see similar trends on the investor side, where definitely the interest seems to be on the transition, especially, maybe the potential benefits of transitioning.
So what is the role that the bond market plays in terms of financing the transition?
Certainly, green bonds, sustainable bonds do play a major role in financing the transition. But of course, you know, transition finance is broader than that, and even broader than just the bond market. Of course, we also have conventional bonds, which can also, you know, contribute to financing transition. So, for example, looking at even conventional bonds issued from companies that provide these green or green transition solutions, such as renewable energy companies, we can also count this as perhaps aiding with the green transition or financing it. So looking at the bond market, we definitely need to go beyond the labels and also look at the activities of the companies that are issuing debt and what are they basically financing with these funds. But going you know, even beyond the bond market, in different places in the world, bond market may not be as evolved or as developed as in some other maybe, you know, markets where with more developed you know, financial and debt markets. So for example, bank loans play a major role in many countries, even in many developed markets. Just bank financing is more prevalent or larger than the bond market. So definitely also as banks are maybe greening their loan portfolios, this would also finance transition. And also we do need to track it if we want to have a fuller picture of how much maybe financing is going to the transition causes. And finally, I would say it's definitely an area which also has experienced very rapid growth in recent years, and that is private credit or private capital in general. So maybe here, what I would say is very interesting that our colleagues have looked into private capital funding transition-related assets, notably those related to renewable energy, green mobility, or energy storage. And while they found that these are dominated by infrastructure funds, private equity, and only to a lesser extent by private credit at this point, but having any visibility into this market, which, you know, traditionally has been, I would say, covered with some opacity, is very important in gauging all of the funds that are going or financing the transition.
And have sustainability concerns made their way to the securitized product world?
Sustainable investment in SP has been trending up in past several years. The agencies have been issuing like green bonds, disclosing social index data for the underlying mortgages. This has become extraordinarily important as the, you know, seasonal hurricanes, house affordability issues, and investors' awareness of CO2 emission and other ESG themes have emerged in newspaper headlines, investor conferences, various policy makers or agencies' agendas. So one announcement I'd like to make is that MSCI is collaborating with Ginnie Mae, one of the three major housing agencies, to work on their ongoing ESG strategies, such as utilizing MSCI real estate data, climate center capability, securitized products analytics to better manage the climate disclosure.
Actually, the subject of sustainability and the effects of climate change came up a few times in my conversation with Yihai. He noted that while delinquencies remain low,
for lower credit tier borrowers, such as some non-QM mortgage sector and subprime auto loans, we do observe already some delinquency pickup. It has not become a major concern yet, as the pickup was, you know, from historically low level, but closely monitoring their performance is certainly warranted.
And that led to my asking Yihai about what may be driving some of that delinquency. Now, this is where the climate change part comes in. It's certainly not his main point, but we did find it interesting that it formed the basis of his example.
There are two components for the credit risk, right? One is the delinquency itself. Some borrowers may go into some sort of a temporary financial hardship
such as you know, hurricane in Florida or certain parts of the country. That kind of delinquency is healthy delinquency. The temporary financial hardship can be resolved by a lot of loss mitigation ways by the either agency or private label servicers. Usually they get resolved very quickly, which means they don't really have any actual loss. Another reason that delinquency may pick up is that there is some sort of a major correction for the job market, and you know, or some geopolitical disaster that can possibly impact the domestic market as well. But I would say that risk is relatively small. And more importantly, the historic home equity or very low, you know, mark-to-market value of those houses, you know, such as you know, a metric called the LTV, is very, very low right now. So the borrowers has enough equity. Even they go delinquent for whatever reason, they can easily just sell the house, and should be enough to cover the sale of the house. So delinquency may go up for certain local areas, but even that's the case, the loss will not be that significant.
We've gotten a pretty good lay of the land about fixed income markets in general over 2024, including the impact of central bank rates, inflation, securitized products like MBS, and sustainable investments such as green bonds. But I did also promise you a look ahead into where fixed income investors may be focused in the new year. What are some of the trends to watch for 2025? We'll start with Afsaneh and make our way around the horn.
2025 would be a very interesting year because it's one of those circumstances or one of those market environment that the direction of the interest rate, the direction of the cost of financing across the markets for both U.S. corporate and non-U.S. corporate can be affected by the sequencing of the monetary and fiscal policy. Let me explain it a little bit more. Let's first start from outside of the U.S. Let's start from Europe. Europe in last year had experienced, as we talked about, uncertainty about the election, especially from what happened in summer, election in France, referendum in France. What we have observed was that the European economy, despite these challenges and weakness in growth, managed to move forward to deliver the growth. But then the inflation rate was below the inflation rate in US. So ECB had more motivation to normalize the rate. So that creates a dynamic that it's favorable for fixed income versus US in terms of the direction of the monetary policy. But at the same time, as we spoke about the challenges, the structural challenges that Europe is facing is putting pressure at increases the tail risk on the growth. So potentially it can be the whole direction of the travel, combination of the monetary policy and the threat to growth is positive for fixed income, but this is positive for not all the best potential reasons. Looking into US, what we are observing is a little bit different. It's still the same kind of like the sequencing between monetary and fiscal policy would drive the direction of the rates and would drive the shape of the curve. But what matters here is that there is a fear, there is a justified fear and the concern about the level of the tariffs, the countries that they are impacted, but will be impacted by the tariff. However, if the tail risk of the tail risk materializes and the tariffs turn into a reality of the world, then they can weigh heavily on both growth and push inflation higher. Then it becomes important that which part of this dual kind of like a measure is reacting first. If we are in a circumstances that the heavy tariffs are pushing growth lower, potentially the Fed has, and even other central banks outside of the US, have the incentive to bring to normalize policy faster to kind of provide some support on in terms of growth. But if the tariffs are basically the effect of them on growth are not as a large drag, and they are pushing inflation higher, then the other side of the story is going to be more dominant. Central banks would have, and especially Fed would have, less of an incentive to normalize the policy. But again, as I said, this seems to be more of a tail risk. This seems to be the and not the central scenario when you look at the positioning in the market. In that sense, given the economic backdrop in the US, it's more likely that Fed continues to gradually normalize the policy with stay data dependent. But there are the perspective of both growth and also labor market rebalancing support further a normalization of the base rate. In that case, if we don't see a major shift in inflation expectation, it's natural to expect to see the belly of the curve start to come off as well, and that we see more further a steepening of the curve. I think what would be interesting in this environment is to see the effect of change of policy on sectors that they are more floating rate sectors, like at the private side of the market. We know that there are concerns about refinancing, role of refinancing coming at the end of 2025 and 2026, and how the companies are going to weather that environment. Naturally, a normalization of the rate would reduce the pressure on the companies, and especially mid-market, and would be good news for continued growth. But if for whatever reason monetary policy basically loses its tools to normalize the monetary policy, loses its appeal to normalize the policy, we would have some challenges. It would introduce some challenges for mid-market companies.
Securitized products during the time period of COVID and 2019 trade tensions much have outperformed the other asset classes, given a strong housing price. During the easing cycle, agency MBS has usually performed well, which is the cycle right now. During the economic growth phase, spread products have usually outperformed the risk-free benchmark. The question then becomes the balance between corporates and securitized products, which are, you know, these two are the obviously the most the biggest spread products. For 2024, Emerge has lagged behind the corporates. Then what about 2025, right? Typically, the dovish monetary policy and the trickle-down fiscal policy has more direct positive impact on corporates. But we know the geopolitical uncertainty may favor domestic mortgages and securitized products, which has less exposure to the global ecosystem. Even the CMBS sector, which has experienced great negative forces in the past several years, may be driven north with the better capital market and potential pro-domestic growth policies. Government guarantee for the agency MBS and a strong HPA support for the private label are two fundamental pillars to support SP as part of an investor's fixed income portfolio. Lastly, risk management, market insights, accurate and timely models and analytics are always key components for the SP portfolio success, right? We at MSCI provide advanced SP models and analytics solutions, back-end risk reports, front-end relative value tools, data visualization.
And Jakub, where do sustainable bonds fit into the fixed income picture for 2025?
Well, certainly interest rates or yields, inflation play a major role when it comes to issuance of bonds. Also, there is always uncertainty about things such as the geopolitical risks and other factors that impact fixed income markets, and by definition will also impact this subsegment of the bond market, which is the sustainable bond market, even if, let's say, sustainable debt may have its own tailwinds and headwinds. But to a large extent, it will be driven by these these macro factors. What is important, though, in trying to really gauge if perhaps sustainable bonds are, you know, doing well or not, is to look at it in the context of the overall bond market or bond issuance. So that is something that we also attempt to do. And one way to do it, or the way we do it, is to look at the proportion of sustainable bonds within our corporate and government bond indexes. So if we, for example, look at just the last 3-4 years, we see that labeled bonds continuously increase their presence in these global bond benchmarks. And especially in the corporate bond space, we see this growth or the proportion of labeled bonds in the corporate bond indexes to increase by about 1% each year. And now they account for more than 6% of our corporate bond benchmarks. This signifies that, you know, even if we see, you know, ups and downs in issuance, sustainable bonds as a, again, subsegment of the global bond market seem to be doing well because we see this proportion increasing. So in the government bond space, this pace is a little bit slower, but we also do see steady increase of labeled bonds in the government bond benchmarks as an indication of whether issuance of these instruments is holding well. We do see that, yeah, it's been doing better than the overall bond market in the last couple of years.
Before we go, let's put all of that together if we can. We'll head back to where we started, trying to understand fixed income in the context of a well-diversified portfolio. Afsana, take us home.
For a long time, basically since post-financial crisis, what we have observed in the market is that the direction of the monetary policy and supported the fixed income market. So there was we were in a very low volatility environment, and the central bank support basically capped any market volatility for a long time. Now we are at an environment that we have directional volatility. As I mentioned, this is the sequencing of the fiscal and monetary policy can really define the direction of the rate, the slope of the curve, and also naturally the volatility that we see in the interest rate. So all of these are the real question, but a lot of these questions are relevant for market risk, managing the market risk of the portfolio. For a lot of investors, for a large group of investors in global market, investors like insurance companies, even retail, part of the role of the fixed income has been, or an important part of the role of fixed income was the diversifying effect. But there is another element into that, and that's a fixed income role that this instrument play in the portfolio of a lot of investors. Now that the interest rate levels are back to the more normal level, the level that we have seen before financial crisis, the total return of the portfolios or the coupon payment of these, a lot of these portfolios are quite significant. So even though it's inevitable that in high volatility environment, the higher market risk reduces the diversifying effect of potentially fixed income, especially in such an environment where when the monetary policy cannot really preempt a lot of market volatility because of the higher level of inflation. So it's natural that in such environment, the diversification effect is a little bit is subdued compared to the previous regime. But providing the income, the role of fixed income asset as a providers of the income is undeniable. It just requires investors to be more careful of the nature of the companies that they are lending to, either the to buying their bonds or participating in private market. The credit element of this assessment becomes more important.
That's all for this year. Our thanks to Afsane, Yihai, and Jakub, and all of our guests throughout 2024. And as always, we are forever grateful to you, our listeners. Now, if you've been wondering what to get your favorite podcast producers for the holidays, might I recommend leaving a rating, leaving a comment, or subscribing to Perspectives wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, regardless of your choice on that matter, Joe and I wish you a safe and joyful holiday season and a very happy new year, when we'll be back with more insights to help you better manage portfolios. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives.